On today's episode.
So you have to use your face. You have to be fronting your brain as soon as possible, because people are attached to people, not to brains.
Around the next curve, Jesse Sam Hickman is in from lying wait. Got a band of rustlers operating in the neighborhood.
Oh, poof. You don't have to be scared.
You're at home with Stacked. Hey, welcome to our very first edition of The Stack Show. My name is Ruben Danaraj, and on behalf of the team, thank you for joining us today. In this series, we speak to top real estate minds as they share with us some personal insights on their lives and beliefs, as well as their tips and tricks for success. Today, we speak to Mr. Stuart Cheng. He's the executive director of Orange Tea & Tie, co-founder of Nevis Living Group, and in more recent times, a proud member of Stacked. On today's show, Stuart shares with us some inspiring snippets of his early life, as well as some tips for both agents and home buyers who are just starting out. We'll also be hearing some of Stuart's insights on the current COVID-19 situation that we find ourselves in. At the end of the show, you can hop on to stackedhomes.com/editorial for more of Stuart, as well as an entire range of quality real estate content. All right, that's enough chit-chat. Let's get to the show. Stuart, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me, Ruben.
Absolutely, and thank you to you as well for joining us today. I know you're very busy. Thanks for setting aside some time. And hello to everyone who's listening in, whether it's morning, afternoon, evening, or night. It's our very first podcast, so a whole ton of things to learn. But hey, if you don't take the step, you remain in the back. All right, Stuart, let's begin today's show by talking a little bit more about your background and how you got to where you are today.
Right, so in my poly days, I think that was midway through my second year to my third year. I was 18, right? So I started to know that my family was going through some difficulties financially.
Right.
So my mom started to have a lot of stress. It was quite a difficult period because while I was studying, on and off, I would get messages about her being very depressed. She owed a lot of debts to credit cards, to loan sharks. It was kind of bad. And before that, I was probably too young and she didn't want to let me know about all this. So midway through my poly, she started to share with us her situation. And it got very bad because she was contemplating suicide. And I was right. Quite helpless. I mean, I'm 18, I'm not very independent or yet financially sufficient at that point. So, it was tough because every call or every message I got at that point, I was afraid something would have happened and it would be from the cops. So anyway, fast forward, what happened was in poly days, I started to learn how to buy and sell. At that point on eBay, right, there's this portal. It used to be very hot for online sales and stuff. So I started to learn to buy and sell stuff on eBay. And then next thing after army, I went in army. I told myself I needed to work really hard so that I could get the best paying job in the while being a NSF. So what was the best paying job? It was to go into OCS and at least get $1,000 a month, right? So I did that. Meanwhile, while maintaining my online sales on weekends, I would go and buy some stuff, sell some stuff. I did a lot of online sales, sold things to Germany, to US, made a lot of online friends, and it was very fun. So that helped me to at least settle some household issues and things that we really need to pay for, like a new sofa set, a new TV set, and very basic stuff. So coming to the end of army, it was very simple for me. I needed to come and work. I knew straight away I didn't have the luxury to have any debt, any more debt, and then of course not to borrow any money to study for my dad, because my dad and mom are separated, divorced. So it wasn't going to come from him either to solve her debt issues.
Sure.
And that was the reason. After army, I came out straight to work. I knew that okay, there's no point trying to get a university education. So so I was pondering my next career move, right? And then I happened to meet a few friends in Borders. At that point, I knew I had to settle a household issue, that means my property issue for my family, my HDB flat to be exact. So I knew that if I get an agent, I'm going to pay 2%. And I went to find out for the course is probably about $600 then, and I could be an agent the same day I took the course. That was crazy.
Wow. And how old were you at this point?
I was out of the army at 23, so that was my chance to solve it, once and for all. So I met these guys, one of them being my BMT platoon mate, and we went for the seminar. We walked in, listened to a very charismatic speaker, and then straight after they assigned us randomly to a manager, and I joined. And I was the only one who joined out of the four of us who were there. And that's it. That was how it started.
Right. And today you lead over 1,000 agents, actually, under your wing. I was reading your blog post recently, and it was actually about how your journey was inspired, how you got into mentoring from sales. Can you share with our listeners a little bit more about how this journey was inspired?
So thanks for reading my blog anyway.
Sure, thanks for mentioning me.
So, you inspired that post. I told you that because after your message about like sharing about more than just real estate topics, I thought I'm really happy that someone asked me to share something beyond that, because I look at life as definitely beyond real estate and beyond sales.
Definitely.
That's why I like to be I like to involve probably my readers with other parts of my life if they're interested.
Sure.
So in 2009, some of my friends started joining me. So other than doing just pure sales, I started also training my friends, and these people were my very close friends, probably the closest friends I have around me. So I had to do trainings for sure, because people trusted me to join me, and to me it's a very huge responsibility on my shoulders. So I trained them, I spent as much time as I can with every one of them individually, and it came to a point where I thought that, hey, the team was growing quite a fair bit. I couldn't afford to train one-on-one the same topics over and over, because that's not effective use of the time, my time. So I started to train them in classes. So every Monday we held Monday sessions together. It was called Monday group sessions. Every morning on Monday, so we'll come in, we'll talk about all topics, all sorts of topics.
Right. Sorry. And how many people were there at this point in your team?
The team was still, I think, pretty small. I can't remember exactly how many we had then. Probably about 20 plus people.
Right.
They about mostly were full-timers. And then I went for my trip. I was still doing my sales, of course. And when I came back, before that, I was already finding it kind of mundane, maybe if it's the right word.
Sure.
Kind of
boring.
Like, not much of a challenge. Yeah, kind of boring. And, hey, am I going to do this forever? Every month, just push for sales, and then, hey, zero again, push for sales, zero, and see how much I make every year. It was nice for a while, because at like 27-year-old, I had a lot of money in my bank.
Yeah.
Maybe making 30 over to 40,000 a month.
Sure.
In fact, the months I went away, right, I had people doing sales for me, I was still making like 20 over 1,000 a month when I was away. So I came back, and then I during the trade, I was talking to myself, hey, do I want that? No, I don't really want that all the way. So what can I do that is by the way I'm already doing, that I don't have to transform myself, go into, you know, something else, oil trading, go and learn a new trade or what. So I thought, hey, I see team leaders, right, leading a team, and they are making passive income from that, in a way passive. I'm not entirely passive, actually. There's a lot of work to
Definitely.
Be done. But at least, there's a different element where instead of helping buyers to buy, you know, and it's usually quite transactional, and we cannot go very deep in conversations with them. Not everybody likes that. But when I mentor agents, right, people, my people share with me a lot of things, and I really appreciate that.
Right, sure. It's actually very interesting that you mentioned helping buyers buy, because that is our next topic, where we're going to be getting to tips for first-time buyers as well as agents who are just starting out in the industry. But just before we get to that, Stuart, are there any traits as a mentor that you both practice and tend to instill in the people that you lead today?
Right, okay. I have a few, if it's okay.
Sure, please go ahead.
Okay, well, the thing is, I have a lot of secret mentors. Everywhere I go, I make it a point to learn from everyone. Whether that person is new to the market, or maybe even not in my market, I try to incorporate their different caps of thinking, so that I can hopefully cross-pollinate ideas across my industry and their industry. Because I believe that if I'm going to be doing exactly what the next real estate leader or salesperson is doing, then I'll probably not ever stand out. It's marginal gains, and it's always a matter of who's more hardworking, who can have more time to burn, and so forth. But I like it that that new ideas always come up whenever I read about stuff, and I hear stuff from people. So then it's up to my creativity to join the dots myself and test out ideas. So it may fail, but it's okay. I have failed so many times, I don't really care right now. And I find that every failure really gets me closer to success sooner. And sometimes it comes to a crossroads that I have never thought of, and a new idea spins off from there that is successful. So it's very interesting. And because of that, I find that execution is everything. Execution, even if you fail, is okay. We fail, we learn, we change strategy. But the problem with probably that I faced earlier in my life also, and with a lot of people I see in real estate, is ideas are plenty, but there's no execution, or there's too much limiting beliefs before they execute. And probably also because of my upbringing, my mom is someone who has always instilled in me to be kind to people, to be respectful to people, to be courteous to people. So please and thank you are a very natural part of my life for me. I know for some people, they won't say thank you until they really feel that something really significant has been done for them. And then they will say their thank yous. And some people would not use their, just not so pleasant or courteous normally. End of the day, yes, people want significance. They want success. They want money and everything. But more important than that, they want significance. So do we give them that basic attention or respect when they have nothing they can offer us? So by doing that, I find by just being that way naturally, I find I make a lot of friends, and I get a lot of surprising things that happen, good things that happen, whether it's a referral, whether it's someone who speaks well of me without me knowing it, or like opportunities that come up because of something they heard about me. So it's very interesting. Yeah, just by giving attention and the time of the day to people, just very simple things like that.
Right. Just to make them feel like they actually matter, right?
I think
there was this book somewhere, I can't for the life of me remember the title of it, but it was along the lines of the number one thing that people love to hear is actually their names, right? So name remembering is such a huge thing. Like very often, you go to a meeting, and I'm so guilty of this, I think all of us are. You go to a party and you're like, hey, my name is this and that, and what's your name? You say that maybe like 10 or 15 times, but how many names do you actually remember, right? And at the end of the day, it's all about giving attention to people, making them feel like they matter.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to be taking a short break right now, but don't go anywhere, because when we come back, we're going to be talking about how you, as a home buyer, can choose the right agent for your home purchase journey. Stuart also shares some opportunities and tips for first-time home buyers just starting out. And if you're a real estate agent listening in, good news, because he's also going to be talking about methods that you can use to reach out to your clients in this day and age, as well as some personal advice catered specially for agents who are just starting out. Stick with us, we'll see you in a bit. All right, welcome back to the show, Stuart. To begin this second segment of our podcast, here's a question. How do buyers choose the right agents for themselves on their home purchase journey?
Right. So I would say always find an agent who's willing to listen to you, to probe into your goals, to ask you about your, what are your plans, and not someone who would want to sell you something straight away, because it's very telling whether that person is interested in a relationship or a transaction.
Sure.
If that person is willing to spend time to understand you and find out your goals, then likelihood that person is interested in a relationship. If they are just tell me what you want and I'll shortlist that for you. Oh, okay. Very cut and dry to the point. I would be very apprehensive to work with such a person. That's a personal choice, all right? Some people like that, so I can't say that my way is always the right way.
Right. Okay, so what about home buyers who are starting out for the very first time? What advice would you give to them?
The things to check for, of course, if you are handling your own buying, or if you're an agent listening in, right, you might want to know as a new agent, what should I ask? Very simply, what can they afford? Okay, for new buyers, young buyers, usually we'll go the BTO route. It's one of the ways to be rather safe because it's their first property. They're going to be taking on debt. A lot of people are not used to that, paying for their own money installments at that point. And they're starting out, their pay might not be high. So to get them to stretch for something else like an EC or private property, I understand that there's a lure of that, of course, because of commissions and so forth. But it's not that we cannot do that to refer them to private markets and EC markets. It's more like we should always show them the choices they have, the options. What are the price points? What are your installments every month? What's the likelihood of price going up? Okay, BTOs, agents usually don't get involved. They go straight, buyers go straight to HDB to buy. So agents do not make any money.
Sure.
But still, when I meet even my clients' daughters and I share with them, or some friends who are really young, 23-year-old, and they are just settling down, and I will just share with them, we have these three choices. If you are able to get a neighborhood that's really good, like the upcoming Bishan BTO, right?
Mm-hmm.
I tell them, go for that. I don't get to earn anything, but it's okay. I think that place has a lot of growth potential. You're going to make some money from it safely, without a lot of risk, because BTOs are the cheapest form of housing you probably can get in the market. So understanding their incomes, understanding whether they have any ability to finance the installments, understanding whether both will be working, do they intend to settle down, have a child straight away, would help me to know how to tweak my recommendations to them. The younger they are, they usually do not know a lot of answers to your question.
Sure.
But that's where we as probably usually older, because agents are usually at least 30s usually.
Sure.
Yeah, of course there are very young ones who join the industry like me, I was 23. But we should have some life experiences to share with them about what to plan for. For example, if you're going to have kids soon and you plan to do it, you're going to settle and have kids soon, then one of the things I would recommend you is to stay near your in-laws. Right?
Right,
if you can help it, and because you really need in-law support as much as possible, and you don't want to be traveling up and down long distances when both of you are working. So I will share things from this point of view so that they know that I don't just care about the transaction, I care about whether they'll be happy after that.
Right.
So yeah, I feel that's where we come in with life experiences,
mm-hmm.
not just transactional and property knowledge.
Sure.
And of course, certain things are like, I also have clients who they know that they do not want BTOs. They want to go straight into private properties because their parents have made some money in private properties before,
yep.
and they do not want to be locked into the MOP period and before they can buy, invest in private properties.
Right.
Yes. So you choose your flat, and that probably takes 3 to 4 years.
Sure.
And then when the flat is ready, you wait another 5 years. So by the time you can sell the place, it's almost 10 years, a decade later. So I will warn people on that this is a real long period. It's not going to be 5 years. It's going to be more than 5 years. So just to let you know, this will be what you're stepping into for a BTO approach.
Got it.
And then on the other side, where people are very convinced that I just want to go for private, I'll still let them know that, you know what, your options are this, this, and this, and what are the pros and cons of each. As long as you go in with not blindly, and you go in with your understanding of all your options on the table, then I feel that I've done my job.
Sure. Sure. That's very, very comforting to hear, Stuart. I think a lot of buyers out there who are listening to this, it will really resonate with them, because sometimes we don't know what we don't know, right? And that's a very general phrase. But it's something that especially young buyers, as you mentioned, the entire MOP thing, 9 years, 10 years down the road, and through those 10 years, so many things can change.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on. This next question is more for, I would reckon, agents who are just starting out, right? So do you have any tips on the methods that you use to reach out to clients in this day and particular age that we're living in?
Right. These days, I find that the methods that are working well for my guys are no longer just blindly telemarketing, throwing off mailers, to use a very simple way of putting it will be the pre-sale process.
Right, and sorry, and that's something that we saw very often as well previously, right? You would see all this name cards of property agents that you wouldn't know, it's like a fresh smiling face, one big number in red, and brochures, all that kind of things. Do you think that's phasing out now as well?
Okay, I know of agents who have done it very consistently. Every single month, they'll be just what we call farming the ground.
Sure.
With flyers, mailers, very well-designed ones. Do I pick it up and read it? Yes, I do. And I'm sure people around the estate pick it up and read it. But are they sticky?
Right.
And are they worth their cost per reach? I find that they are not the best
approach. Sure.
Yes, you will definitely get clients if you bother to call 100 people, 1,000 people, or you bother to throw so many mailers, I'm sure you'll get success. But I find that that's not the best use of time and effort. And it's not the most sticky way that's long-term. So I like to think long-term.
Right.
And with that in mind, the best way today is content creation. So okay. Yeah, that's how we met also, right? Yeah,
exactly.
Through writing. Yeah, because it sticks. Whatever effort you put into it, it sticks. It stays there forever. And maybe even if it's a topic that's only trending like now, COVID is a topic that's trending. Sure. Right? In the future, can it still be used? Yes, it can still be used. It can be repurposed easily just by editing a little bit here and there out. And you can get a content to be a classic content that's, you know, has a lifetime value instead of a one-time value,
right.
One-time chance. Yeah. So whether it's through, now we are doing podcasts, it's still very new to the Singapore market. So I hope this takes off.
Sure, hopefully. Fingers
but
crossed.
If not, I'm sure the wave will come. Yeah. Yeah, if not, I'm sure the wave will come. We are always a little bit lagging behind in tech compared to the US, but it should catch up in time.
Sure.
Like videos, my guys, since about 2.5 years back when we started Navis, there were a couple of things that we really focused on. So one of them was content, digital content, writings. If you can write, if you can't write, you can always hire someone to write and then put in your points and make it yours.
Sure.
If they are good in on video, they are not shy, or you can even learn it. Even if you are shy, you can learn. Everything is possible. Yeah, just have to take that step out, right? So digital content is good, audio content is good, or social media content. Some of my friends do it every day. So they religiously put up short excerpts of what they have been doing, their day, the case studies that they have been about clients they've met, and so forth. These are content that stays online and subsequently is easily shared. It sells you, pre-sells you to anyone who's watching mm-hmm. them while you're asleep.
Right.
Yeah. So in time to come, I look at it this way: you have more than 24 hours a day because your presence is everywhere. You're not you're in the past we could only sell when we are physically there or when our mailers reach them, and mailers are not kept usually, or when we make a telemarketing phone call, right? But subsequently, now with digital content, your content is 24/7 is there. 10 people could be looking at it at once, but your mailer can only be in one place at once. Your physical presence can only be in one place at once. So scaling up the business and using what I call force multipliers, kind of like in the army, right? Sure. One soldier is supposed to take on how many, I can't remember the army ratio anymore, 1 to 4, 1 to 3. Yeah, but now you can take on more in real estate because of digital assets.
Right, right. And it stays there forever. It's a database that can be accessed 5, 10, 15 years down the road.
Exactly.
Wonderful.
Yes, it stacks.
It stacks.
Yeah, the content you create stacks. Yeah, I mean, intended, yes.
Thanks for that. All right, Stuart. Last question before we head off for our final break, after which we'll be coming back to talk a little bit more about the current COVID-19 situation we find ourselves in. Final question, and once again, this is for agents who are just starting out, a little bit green behind the ears, as you mentioned earlier today. Do you have any advice, personal advice for them as they begin their journey in this harsh but fulfilling industry?
Yeah, okay. So young people who want to join this trade, and I speak from being there before. Being young, we want to buy the nicest cars, the sportiest things around, you know, the nicest watch and so on. And that's the things that drive us for that wow, that phase of life, perhaps. And for many agents, I've seen them come and go. Why? Because initial years of their career, they are very driven, especially the young agents. They have all the time in the world. They have all the energy in the world. They have no clients. They treat every client like gold. Sure. And you know, like that. Yeah, they're only one. And that's great. But always be thinking long term, right? Because I wish I had done so many things when I was in my 20s that I only came around to doing when I'm like in my 30s. And it's a pity I could have this last decade really work in my favor if I had overcome my own limiting beliefs early on. So things like, for example, people are always thinking, hey, I'm not good enough, I'm not experienced enough to start my blog, to start my website, to appear on camera, to do a video channel, to start Instagram and sharing all my things. I'm not good enough, no one is interested. Why would people be interested? I think I'll just do a substandard job. Oh, I wait until the day I'm ready. So the thing is, you will never, ever, ever be ready. Even till today, 14 years in this line, I still feel naked in certain things that I do. Like this podcast, this is the first time we're doing a podcast, right? There, I still feel, you know, unprepared for certain situations or events. But the beauty of it is whenever you commit to doing it, you say that, hey, I don't care. Even if I'm not good enough, I will just do it first. I'll just do it first and then I will find a way. You know, like probably a lot of entrepreneurs around the world will say that you say okay first and then you deliver, right? You find a way to deliver. It's not being irresponsible. It's forcing yourself to a deadline to commit to doing something. And once that you commit to that, a lot of doors and a lot of resources you have in you just open up that you didn't even know exist. You didn't even know you're so good, so fluent, so ready until you put that pen to paper.
Right.
Or you put, you know, your fingers to the right. keyboard per se.
Right.
Yeah. So just get started. Don't think too much about how people will think of you. I used to be like that. I would think about, I was a perfectionist. And why was I a perfectionist? Because I'm always afraid, hey, I put this out, my work out, how will people judge me?
Sure.
So I'm too concerned about what people think of me. And trust me, most times you think about yourself too much. You imagine that fear in your own mind. People don't think about you that much until you are someone.
Right.
Right? Until you're someone. So if you're starting out, you have nothing to lose, go all out. Use all the channels that exist today, social media channels that don't exist in our times, and start a brand for yourself as early as possible.
Right.
And don't hide behind a brand. I used to hide behind a logo, meaning I used to let the logo define my results, my East Living Group. So I won't put myself in front of it, I'll put myself behind it. And it took me many years before I say, hey, no, you know what? People are never attached to a logo. They are never attached to, okay, of course, unless you are an Apple or, you know, a Nike or what, where you really have that much marketing budget and resources to put your ads everywhere. But for a usual real estate person, we don't have that. So you have to use your face. You have to be fronting your brand as soon as possible, because people are attached to people, not to brands.
Right.
And start thinking long term. It's always important to also keep in contact, connect with old clients all the time.
Sure.
Yeah. It's very attractive to always be chasing new leads. It sounds very attractive that, you know, I have a lead generation funnel, I invest in PPC, and I get a lot of leads every day, every week, and so on, right? But new leads do not have a relationship with you. People who are who have been your life, who have shared a certain chapter with you, there's a lot more connections and depth to that relationship than you can expect with new ones coming in. Yeah, so always reinforce the old ones. Find ways to help your clients also. Some things that if they are F&B owners, support them. If they are in a banner printing trade or in social media marketing trade, support them. So because it's a win-win. Yeah, people like people who help them and help their cause. So don't just make it all about you and what you can get. People who do that often, more often than not, I see them fail and become very upset with the world. Feel very indignant about how, no matter how hard they work, they don't get any results. But that's because it all starts from being too self-centered. So start to be willing to give as soon as possible. Even if, you know, sometimes you get taken advantage of, right? Sorry, I'm going on
sure,
and
sure.
on. But yeah, this is also an important thing I wrote about on my blog. In Mandarin, we call it 吃亏一点不用紧. Yeah, 吃亏一点不用紧. That means being taken advantage of is okay. Of course, you have to be wise. There's always a line to draw within wisdom of letting being taken advantage a little bit versus, you know, overly just stripped naked,
right?
So a little bit is okay. That means that you are useful to someone. And because people would like to know who you are, how are you like, by asking you things, by consulting you, right? Before they decide whether you're the right one to work with. So don't take it too personally that people are making use of you and then getting free info and so on. So be willing to, especially as a new person, right? Be willing to spend more time with people without expecting that everyone has to convert into a lead. And don't be too upset if after like you serve them for so long and you don't get the deal, right? Take it as a learning reflection. Don't take it personally. you can always improve and be better.
Right.
Yeah, I was horrid when I started off. I'm better now, not great yet, but better now. And it's because I'm always learning from my failures, and I'm willing to look bad, in a way, look bad by failing and then improving from
there.
So yeah, don't take it to heart and just move on.
All right, some very lovely pointers right there. Experience and wisdom coming together. Okay, we're going to be taking our final break for the day. When we get back, we're going to be talking about the current COVID-19 situation that we find ourselves in and the global and local effects that we can expect to face from it, as well as a little tidbit on developer discounts. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back, Stuart. This question is a little bit more current, and I know that the both of them are not similar in many regards, but having been through the entire GFC or you know, the global financial crisis of 08-09, are you able to paint any similarities based on your experience to the current COVID-19 situation that we find ourselves in today in the year 2020?
Well, I think there's for now at this stage of COVID, there are very different measures that's been taken compared to GFC, the global financial crisis.
Sure.
So in global financial crisis, I'm very active in the stock market too. So I saw yes, there were of course the stimulus, government stimulus and so on, but I guess the government didn't come out as strongly as they did this time around. And because of the temporary relief measures, if you follow the news. For property developers and property owners and all the different loans and so forth that we didn't see in the past crisis. This time round, people are entering this crisis with a lot more confidence, and the fear in the air isn't as thick as before. Yeah.
Sure.
So that's my feel. It is not similar yet. Yeah. Will it be similar later on? I hope not. Because the temporary relief measures are temporary, not permanent.
Sure.
And how long would that go on is a question mark for everyone yet.
Right.
Yeah. So at this point, I don't see many similarities. Of course, there are people who are jittery and would have to, you are a little bit more willing. Yeah, maybe you can say that similarities, people are willing to accept lower offers and they are more realistic naturally. Yeah, when you have a lot more, like the ratio to negative news is to positive news every day is, you know, way higher.
Sure. Definitely.
Yeah, versus in normal times, especially the start of the year, if you remember that DBS, Business Times, Straits Times, and probably all the analysts in the market were saying how bullish 2020 is going to be.
Yeah.
It's going to be a fantastic year.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but this time around, at that point, there were a lot of positive news. So people were, you know, spending a lot, consuming a lot. Money velocity was very high, but now it's different.
Sure.
Yeah, now people are holding back. Yeah.
Right. And you know, Stuart, I would like to think of myself as a relatively positive person. In this current age where everything is just freaking doom and gloom everywhere we go,
yeah.
Are there any positive lights at the end of the tunnel that you know, people like me or people in general can look forward to?
I see some spots, some bright spots. Why? Because when every time it comes to a monetary stimulus, right,
Printing
of what we call a money tsunami coming into the whole market, stock markets go up and new heroes are born. Tech heroes, new companies are listed, like today that one of these firm chose to list during this period, and they start to do very well. So the bright spots are that this, because they are doing well, they are now listed and they have funding. Jobs can be created by these people fast enough to replace those loss. And sadly, because some businesses are meant to have modernized but failed to and have to fail, I guess they would. But I guess with the whole world and people are all trying to create jobs, even like Singapore is creating a lot of jobs for even like our air stewards, and those who have no jobs, they are getting jobs. Patrolling, social distancing, and so forth. So I think with the world doing that, that should mitigate losses.
Right. Okay. Let's zoom in a little more locally. What is your outlook on the Singapore market? Are we going to be seeing a period of stagnation, or is there perhaps a surprise on the cards for all of us?
Yeah, that the cure won't be so soon. The vaccine needs to happen, have to be developed. That takes time, and no matter what, that you can't rush it out in 1 month, even if the whole world working on it. So the vaccine has to be there. The cure has to be developed before things will fully recover. So I'm pretty sure we'll go through some periods of some form of stagnation in the market.
Sure.
But in Singapore, because we have to also look at geopolitical markets.
Absolutely.
With money flowing out of the US, people are afraid, right, because of the money printing tsunami that's going to happen. Is the USD going to devalue against many other currencies? So if it's going to devalue due to overprinting of money, it's like the banana notes when we were young, not young, we were not born yet,
sure.
The Japanese times, right, where banana notes start to occur because you've got to bring a lot of money and money devalued so quickly. So if that's the case, money may flow out of US. And where will they flow to? Well, they will flow to traditionally top financial markets, London. But London is going through an endless, eternal Brexit that never happens. I'm not too sure when it happens. And people are also afraid of going there,
sure.
Right? Then they will go to where? Switzerland, yeah. But Switzerland, yes, but things are so costly there. And not everybody is prepared to put funds in just in Europe. And then there's where? Hong Kong, Tokyo. Well, Tokyo has its share of issues with an aging population, lower spending, GDP, isn't growing as fast as they want to. In Hong Kong, we all know what's happening. So there are not many financial wealth hubs in the world like Singapore that is kind of sheltered from the political fights in the world.
Sure.
And have access to Chinese markets, which is very important still.
Right.
So with that, I am just quietly confident that we will be attracting a lot of high net worth people coming here as a shelter, as a second home, to make sure that if anything happens back home or things that I can't, I can't control, even though how wealthy they are, they might want to have a backup plan. And for that, I'm quietly confident that we will not suffer as bad a blow as the GFC.
Right. Absolutely, that's a brilliant point, Stuart. In fact, I think some of the top analysts, so CBRE and a couple of the other top companies, have actually mentioned this, how Singapore's safety and stability will be a haven of comfort for investors in this coming months or even coming years. So that's very good to hear. That being said, we do have a little issue of an oversupply, right? In the 17-18 en bloc craze, we saw a lot of new, based on that craze, we're going to be seeing a lot of new launches coming to the market. 2020 was supposed to be the year of the new launch, but unfortunately, I think most of the show feds are closed right now.
No one can go there.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. Right? So that being said, and I know that the government has already added in some ABSD extensions, they've added in, I think, 6 months for developers, so they don't have to rush. But that being said, do you see that there's going to be continued discounts, developer discounts of new launches coming into the market?
Okay, this past 2 months, there have been already some discounts being given. So like yesterday, I was representing Stack Homes, right, on BT to talk about a few discounts in the market. So there were some that discounted as little as $3,000 that was treasured at Tampines, if I remember correctly. Yeah, and they moved a lot of units just purely based on an additional discount of $3,000 for their one roomers, like there's $700,000. So they sold everything. All the one bedrooms were sold out during COVID. So, and then there were also those who were at the other spectrum, like for example, Itz and Thomas. There were units that were discounted from, because Itz and Thomas in usually sold about 3,000 to 3,000-ish BSF. But this time round, in the past week or so, there were a few units sold at 2,006 to 2,007 per square foot. That's about $400 off per square foot. And imagine it's 1,000 square feet, it's 400,000 off. And they were sold, and just today, in fact, we heard that the discount has been pulled back because the developers were probably not expecting this response and were afraid they were, you know, over discounting too soon. Yeah, maybe the peers in the real estate market were developers were also making some noise with the, hey, why are you spoiling the market kind of thing. I'm not too sure. Yeah.
Right. So you mentioned about that $400 PSF discount. So at 1,000 square feet, that's about what, 400K off your purchase? That being so, in that sense, will the units who were sold at, let's say, 2.6, will they then be undervalued as compared to their 3K counterparts? So, for example, 5-10 years down the road, are the units that were sold at 2.6 going to be less, lower valued? Right. And in that sense, isn't there massive upside potential for that?
Based on normal times, and especially when most units are sold at 3,000 per square feet and you are able to buy at 2.6 to 2.7, that's about more than 10% off the normal, most buyer's price. I would say you have a very good chance of making a profit. Why? Because humans naturally have a tendency towards loss aversion.
Sure.
So the you probably heard this before.
Yep.
The joy of making a dollar, the joy is lesser than the pain of losing that dollar.
Definitely.
If you go to a casino and you win $1,000, you might be happy for a little while. But if you lose $1,000 and you walk out, you feel that pain for quite long, much longer than the joy you would otherwise have felt. So because of this loss aversion kind of psychology, people just don't want to lose. Everybody wants to win, feel like they came out a winner. So owners who have bought at 3,000 would naturally not want to sell below 3,000, even if they just have to sell at break even and make back their stamp duties, brokerage fees and stuff like that. They would not want to sell below that. So most people are like that. So you will find the odd one or the really suey one, right? We call it unfortunate one, where they really lost their business or lost money elsewhere and they have to force sell. But these are the minority. In any, how many of friends have actually have been forced to sell a property because of a business loss of bankruptcy or so on? Most of us don't have many friends like that. Most of them will say that, I don't make, right? I will rent it out. It's okay. I'll hold till I make money. Most people are like that. So if you go by the probability of making money, if you manage to buy it 2,600 or 2,700 per square foot, it's just a matter of time. Because you can sell at 3,000, you can sell at the other people's, the neighbor's cost price and still make money while they have to wait for the prices to go much further. So you have a better tendency to, but I'm not saying guaranteed, because it also depends whether land prices around that estate, around that district, right, similarly rebounds, or whether that project itself has good attributes. Sometimes if that project, you get a discount, but hey, you didn't know that there are some blind spots. Perhaps the finishing is really horrible. Perhaps there are defects with the building and construction. Perhaps the smell from the nearby canal is so bad that people just can't stand staying there after a while. So as long as this there's no such issues, then generally it should make money for the owner.
Right. Wonderful. All right, Stuart, I think that's all the time we have left for today. Thank you again for joining us. I know you're a very, very busy man. We've all learned so much from you, and we do hope very much that you will join us on the show again in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ruben. It's a pleasure speaking to you too.
Humble, down to earth, yet incredibly wise and experienced, this has been an episode with none other than Mr. Stuart Cheng. On behalf of the guys over here at Stacked, I hope that you've been able to take something away from today's show, as I have as well. If you're interested in checking out some more incredible real estate content from Stuart, myself, and a whole bunch of other incredibly fun and talented individuals, be sure to hop on to stackedhomes.com/editorial. If you have any comments, queries, or suggestions, you can reach us via email at hello@stackedhomes.com. Thanks for joining us. My name is Ruben Danaraj, and I'll see you in the next podcast. So, very curious about this. Is there then potential for upside? For example, those 2.6K units, right? Will they then be undervalued than their 3K counterparts? Counterparts. My goodness, I'm so sorry.